Órale pues, Raza, welcome to Chicano Highlights. I am your host, The Beto Man, and we have a very special guest here today. We have Mr. Johnny Hernandez. ¿Cómo estás?
Beto, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation. Doing fine, carnal.
All right, so let's start off with your background, carnal. ¿Cómo se llaman tu papá y tu mamá?
My father's name was Salvador Hernandez. Mom was Amelia de Leon Hernandez.
And where were they from?
Mom was born in Cerritos, Aguascalientes. And Pop was born in San Luis Potosí, San Luis Potosí.
All right. And why did they travel into Texas?
During the Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, Pancho Villa, a lot of people migrated to Texas, de Mexico. And my mother's father, Coronel José María de León, was a Villista fighting with Pancho Villa. And he was, you know, in the revolution. And mom took off with Las Tías and all of that. And they took off to Texas, Central Texas, ended up in a ranch called Sneed Ranch. And Pop and his family, of course they were kids, you know, did the same thing and ended up in the same ranch. So eventually they grew up and met, and that's where they came from, Mexico.
All right. And where did you guys end up?
Well, like I said, they ended up in Central Texas, Sneed Ranch. You know, they met at a fiesta, 16 de septiembre, I believe, because Pop and his brother were troubadours, and always singing and playing the guitars and everywhere. And Pop, I think Mom was la reina de la fiesta, and Pop saw her, and that was it. You know? And he had a friend at the time, Felipón de León. Felipe de León was like 6'4", 6'5". Pop was like 5'6", 5'7". Mud and Jeff, you know. But they were best of friends. And they each had a sister. And Pop told Felipe, they call him Felipón, me voy a robar a tu hermana. And Felipón told Pop, I'm going to steal yours. Y se robaron las hermanas. And the family sprouted from that.
All right. And so how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Originally, we were 13 siblings.
Can you name them all for me?
Yeah. The oldest going down, Tony, referred to Tony Top from Top Sergeant in the Airborne, deceased now. And next to him was Porfirio, also military all his life career. And he just passed away. They passed away a couple of years apart, a few years ago. Then Lupe, still alive. Mary, or Mere, still alive. Jimmy, carnal, Jimmy lives here in Corona. La Vispa, his real name is Santiago. They call him La Vispa for reasons I can't disclose. And then after him was Clarita, who died of La Mollera. So she was an infant and died, and she didn't grow up with the family. But after that came Joe, little Joe, and then my brother Jesse, who was part of her band, and got killed in a car accident, mm-hmm, when he was, I think, 20. And then myself, and then after me is Carmen, Carolyn, Rocky, and Gilbert.
Wow. ¿Verdad? Muchos niños, ¿verdad?
Oh, yeah. And it was the way it was back then. All the families were large families.
So where did you guys grow up as kids? As
we grew up in my hometown of Temple, Texas.
And where is that at, más o menos, from San
Antonio? It's Central Texas. It's, we brag a lot, Tejanos, deep in the heart of Texas, ¿verdad? Mm-hmm. So it's on I-35. If you're going from San Antonio north, you're going to go on I-35, you're going to go to about 60, 70 miles to Austin. Then you're going to keep going another 65 miles, you're going to hit Temple. Then you're going to go 35 miles, and you're going to hit Waco. And then you're going to go up another 100 miles, and you're going to hit Dallas. So we're right in the middle.
Okay, gotcha, gotcha. Well, it's good to know, ¿verdad? Porque como no somos de allá, some of us no somos de allá, no sabemos, ¿verdad?
Well, you know, I'm very proud of my hometown, of where I'm from. A lot of times in my career, especially in California, sometimes they would say, when I was doing a show, Johnny Hernandez de San Antonio. And I'd say, excuse me, no, I'm from Temple, Texas.
Okay.
You know, because that's where I was born. I was born in a house.
All right. Now, where did you go to schooling, to school?
There in Temple, I went to Reagan Elementary. Mm-hmm. First, I went to Bentley Hill, but I wasn't ready. And I was a little boy. And, of course, you know, but my birthday being in November, I was premature. I wasn't of age yet, but mom, they go, take him. So my brother Jesse and Joe, a.k.a. Jesse was, Chewy, and Joe was Chema. They took me with them to Bentley Hill, put me in a room. I didn't speak a word of English, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, what's going on here, you know? Where did they go? So the white lady starts talking, and I get up and start running through the halls, and Chema, Chewy, looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher goes after me and brings me back, and that happened 2 or 3 times, you know. And yo estaba terco, where's my brothers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they would come back and tell me, hey, you got to stay here. You know, this is your classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to have it, so I finally got tired. And I said, es que esta gente no me entiende. I'm thinking to myself, they don't know what they're doing here,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked out and sat down in the front steps. And I said, I'm just going to wait till school's over. And Chewy and Chema, or Chemo, either way, come and take me home. And the teacher told him, you know, your brother's not ready for school. So that was Bentley Hill. Mm-hmm. After the following year, I went to Emerson School for a month or two, and then we moved, and then I went to Reagan Elementary. We used to walk to it like most kids did, probably about a mile away, at least, or a mile and a half, gravel roads and all of that, you know. And, I grew up in a world of that we can get into with hardships and racism and ridicule. And, you know, when you go to school, you already know, because Central Texas was not like West Texas or South Texas that had a lot of raza. We weren't like that in Central Texas. So elementary school, I met about 10 other Chicanitos, and the rest were all white. It was a sea of white people. And being in Central Texas, close to Waco and Dallas, where it was known that the KKK, you know, was very strong and all of that, I had to grow up dealing with that from day one and fighting physically, you know, with the racist. Not all whites were racist, and they aren't, but a lot of them were. And I grew up having to deal with that. And not only that, I didn't know English. And then I'm going to school with secondhand clothes and holes in the bottom of my shoes. And they're laughing at me and picking fights. And I never wanted to go to school. To me, going to school was like going to the penitentiary every day, man, and having to fight it out. And then, you know, you meet the good whites. And, you know, something very magical, Bethel, man, is that for all the whites that were in that school or in town, everywhere, that could be, you know, hateful and arrogant and just abusive, you make one white friend and it erases all that, because that one white person treats you like a human being.
Right.
And for a moment you forget the ugliness of racism. And there were several gabachitos that would hang out with us, you know. But that's the world that I came from, dealing with that from day one. And I went through Reagan School. And the thing was, Beto, man, that if you got into a fight with a kid, you know, you might get a black eye or, you know, sore nose or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
2-3 days later, busted lip or whatever, it goes away. But when you're a little boy and the grown-up person, racist, attacks you verbally, and you, what do? You look at him, you can't fight him. Those scars stay forever.
Right.
That's why if you go to my Facebook page, I am so involved with what's happening. Because after growing through all that, growing up in that world, I found a place where I can voice my opinion. Y todos los camaradas that agree with me jump in, all the cotton pickers and everything. And that's why I'm so active on Facebook with regards to that.
All right. So let's continue here. Now, where did you go to middle school?
That was, we call it junior high school, Travis Junior High. And, of course, the whole raza ganguita that we were all in Reagan Elementary, the same ones went all over on to Travis Junior High. And the same situations continued. So I never learned anything in school, carnal. I couldn't think. I didn't want to be there. And I was, you know, I failed the first grade. The only time I failed, Miss Chaffin, God bless her, that teacher was so kind to me. She reminded me of my aunts always taking care of you, you know. So that was a blessing. That was the first grade. And I failed, and then from there I never failed. And I was wondering, how can I pass? I don't know anything. I didn't answer any questions. I have bad grades. Well, later on in life I realized that so that they could look good, they were passing me. And so that they could look good, when I was, the censuses were coming around, and they'd say, make your mark right here, Johnny. Anglo-Saxon, that's you. You know, it was false. It has been false forever, you know. So as the, I was in Travis Junior High, went to the ninth grade, and then I quit school.
Okay. All right. Now, your family was a worker, migrant family that went back and forth picking, right?
We're cotton pickers. We still are. You know, once you're a cotton picker, it's forever.
Tell me a little bit about cotton picking. I no sé nada.
Okay, well, you have to get up, you know, 5 in the morning. All you see out in the middle of the ranch is darkness, except for your neighbors, you know, 2-3 blocks into the wilderness, the lanterns, because we didn't have electricity. Of course, everybody used the outhouse, and we had a well to where we got the water from, you know, from the well. So you wake up at 5 in the morning, and mom starts cooking, and you start hearing, you see the lights through the wilderness, through the trees, you know, because it's still dark, and you see the little lights going on, the little lanterns everywhere where you can see your neighbors, which are few and far apart. And then you start hearing music, you know, radios. And that's how your day starts. Mom cooks, we all eat, we go down a couple of miles, and we hit it. And it's 100 degrees, 105, 102, or 98, and you pick cotton. Actually, I got to pick cotton, and then it became pulling cotton. The difference is picking cotton, is el capullo, is the, you know, that green cotton bull? It opens up and it hardens up, and it turns and turns real prickly and prickly, you know, te pica las manos, you know. But picking cotton is where you get the cotton and pull it out of that capullo. So all you have is cotton. And they would pay you $1.50 for 100 pounds, you know. And then it became pulling cotton, where estiras todo el capullo that is already dried. And you don't pick the cotton out of it. You pull it completely, and you throw it in the sack. So you do that, and you're in an environment where there's no facilities, nothing, not even an outhouse, you know. It's hot. The feet, you can feel the dirt, the heat coming through your feet. And, you know, this is an everyday thing. That the women are pregnant, and they're pulling that cotton sack. And you know, you have to go until you fill your sack before you can actually carry it to the trailer and have a drink of water. To this day, I love water, carnal. I drink it all the time, cold water, because las barricas, the wooden barrels, and they would put this big blocks of ice in them. And water never tasted so good when you finally got to it, you know. So it's an all-day thing, and you work till the sun's going down.
And tell me, did anybody ever get bit, like from animals?
Yeah.
Snakes?
Yeah, there were always snakes, copperheads, rattlers, tarantulas, praying mantis, bees, bumblebees, spiders, all kinds of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. But you learn to, to live with it. You could be walking, and I actually remember the last time I was in a cotton field, and I was already in my teens, and I was walking, and as I lifted my foot to put it down again, there was this a snake coiled up. They said it was a copperhead, big snake, man. And, you just walk around it, you know. You get used to these conditions, you know. But, yeah, I have an aunt who got bit by one, and she didn't die, luckily. I think it was a rattler that bit her. Mm-hmm. But it did leave her a little absent-minded, if you will, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But she survived it. And it was a rough life. And hard.
Now, is it true that the planes would go overhead and drop melathion and DDT just on people that were picking everything?
They'd spray the fields, you know. Not all the times when we were working, but there were times when they did. Mm-hmm. And but talking about DDT, Carnal, it wasn't bad enough that they were doing it out there. And El Barrio, in the house that I was born in, it was a predominantly black neighborhood, and just a few Chicanos, and some of them were my cousins and family, you know. Cuando venía el DDT, we'd all run behind the truck, you know, because we thought it was a cloud. And luckily, I don't have a third ear or a third eye. You know, todos los kids running right into that stuff, man. Right.
Now, for those listeners who are listening, DDT was a poison that was eliminated from spraying because it caused a lot of damage to not just the crops, but to people.
Yeah, and we'd run inside the cloud.
Wow. You know,
so, innocence, you know, the Great Spirit was with us.
Exactly. Now, so we continue here. So you dropped out of school, and so what did you do for the next, couple of years? Did you go to the army? Did you get married? ¿Qué pasó?
Well, I dropped out because I was 16, mm-hmm. and I met this beautiful girl, also named Hernandez, Mary Hernandez. Mm-hmm. Our parents were compadres, actually. Mm-hmm. Hernandez y Hernandez, mm-hmm. families. We fell in love, and you're a kid, you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's a funny story, but from elementary through junior high, I was always fine, like I said, you know. And I would be, the kids would attack me, the bad ones, the white ones. I would fight, and I was the one that was sent to the principal's office to get my spanking. And it got to where I said, well, you know what? I don't mind getting a spanking. I earned it, you know. And a principal from elementary, Mr. Bentley, spanked me there. And then he moved on to Travis. And Mr. Farrell took over the job of spanking me, you know. And then when I moved on to junior high, Mr. Bentley looked at me, uh-oh, you know. So then it became a thing like, okay, I was... harassed and abused verbally, so I want to defend myself and then go get my spanking, you know. And I saw it. He and Mr. Bentley was not a racist person at all. He was a good man. Mm-hmm. And I saw it. He's not spanking me because he's racist. He's spanking me because he has to. And I'm getting the spanking because I have to defend myself. So I'm doing what I have to do, and he's doing what he has to do.
Right, but
we're okay.
It's still a double victimization.
Of course it is.
Because, you know, of course.
And a double standard.
And a double standard, exactly.
Yeah, so he knew me well. The day I walked in to quit school in the middle of the ninth grade, Johnny, what is it this time? I said, I am quitting school. Oh, yeah? And why? I said, I'm getting married. Pobrecito, man, he was white, and he turned pale.
Mm.
He turned pale because that was the last thing he expected to hear. Mm. But he also turned pale because he looked at me, 16 years old, 110 pounds or whatever, you know, as the chiquito short and not knowing anything. And he thought, you know, does he understand what he's telling me? He really felt bad for me that, you know, I wasn't prepared for life and all of that. And every time he spanked me, he would talk to me, give me a lecture. This time, he just asked a couple of questions. And when he saw that I wasn't going to change, you know, he said, well, do you have your parents written letter that they approve, you know? I said, yes, I have it right here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just bewildered and like, man, I don't know what to tell this little rebel, you know. Nothing I say is going to change his mind. And he was in shock, you know. And I was standing there with my khakis and my calcos with my double soles, you know.
Wow.
The pachuquito, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing my ground.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. And he said, okay. He signed a release. And I walked out of there and got married at age 16.
All right. So did you have kids?
Yes. You asked what I did after that.
Mm-hmm.
First job I got was washing dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Pop, my old man, who was a.k.a. La Cotorra,
mm-hmm.
Had a good friend who ran the Elite Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Good friend of a white man. Just couldn't be nicer, you know. And he got me a job, so I walked in and introduced myself, and the man was real cool. Okay, Johnny, just go back there, and Mr. So-and-so, a good friend that I knew, Mexicano, was in charge of the kitchen, so all the waitresses, hey, darling, you know, this was a different cut of whites. And by the way, I'd like to mention that the racism, for the most part, was in the cities. Los ranchos, you know, whether they were racist or not, they didn't display it. They were kind to us. And, of course, we worked with them. And they spoke a little bit of Spanish, you know, but they were good people.
Mm-hmm.
And so were some of the town people. But I went and got my first job. I walked to it from the house at the downtown temple. I don't know, 2-3 miles, whatever it was, you know. And I had to walk at 5 in the morning on the street, and then I hit the tracks, and then I go through the tracks, and then I finally go to downtown, and just a little boy. I had my knife in my right pocket in case anybody attacked me, you know. And that's how I started working. But I was a sub. Somebody was on vacation. So I worked for a couple of weeks, and I said, okay, I actually worked out of the cotton fields in a job in the white world, you know. So I was cool with that. And when the 2-3 weeks was up, I went to the Han Hotel and applied, and more good people. The lady was, the two managers, cooks, were husband and wife. I think they were Czechoslovakian Bohemians, you know, and they were beautiful people, man. And the waitress and they just treated me real good. I got introduced to what is that pie? Banana cream pie.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said, you can eat anything you want, Johnny. Coming from the cotton fields, kind of, you know,
right.
It's a whole different world.
Yeah.
And
how many jobs did you hold? I mean,
well, I held those two, and then my brother-in-law, whose name was Joe Hernandez, God bless him.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's brother, the eldest, he had taken a couple of his brothers to work with him in Fort Worth, building bridges, which is an extremely hard line of work. Dangerous. People get killed. People get their hands cut off and everything. He took one or two of his brothers, and he was a hard man because of the danger of the environment. And they ran out on him. And then he took his brother-in-law, and he worked a little bit, and then they went back home. And he took me, you know. And I put up with it. I came from the cotton fields. What could be harder? And I knew zero when I walked in. And I was a carpenter's helper, and we were building bridges, and dealing with the mud and the cold and the hot. And then I went back home and told him, you know what? De todos los hombres que I brought over here, this little boy is the only one that put up with the job. So we became, he became like a second father to me. Mm-hmm. And that's where, in Fort Worth, where we had our first child, boy, Johnny, John Jay, we call him. Mm-hmm. This was in 62. Mm-hmm. And while I was working there, I mentioned Jesse, my brother. Jesse was a bass player for the band Little Joe and the Latinaires, but he was really the guy behind Little Joe, the guy that was watching everything that was happening in the world, and the guy who was saying, you know, you need to do this. He was a force of nature, and we ran the streets together, you know, before all of this happened. We were in Parla, La Huacho, La Canguita, and all of that, so Jesse and I were tight, but in the band, Joe depended a lot on his intuition as to where to go next and what to do. And so Jesse called me one day and he says, Johnny, quit your job. He drafted me into the band. And he says, you're married and you already have your firstborn. So what I did is, Joe and I are working at this plant where they make pants, and I got you my job. I'm going to quit my job and you're going to take over. And that's when Jesse told Little Joe and me and the rest of the band, he said, I'm either going to make it in music or I'm going to starve. But that's it. It's music, you know. And because of his dedication, it's what gave us the drive to go beyond the city into other little towns. They had gone into little towns around there, but to record. And, you know, he instilled that inspiration of making it, you know. And and then he got killed in the car accident. But he brought me into the Latinaires. And
And this was your older brother, right?
He was older than me, younger than Little Joe.
Okay. All right. So let's just step back just a little tad, okay? Now tell me about Little Joe and the Latineers. When did this band start?
It actually started as David Coronado and the Latineers. David was her cousin. David was an incredibly gifted musician. When he was 17, 18, he was already playing like Cannonball Adderley, man, or Coltrane, I dare say. He was just gifted. You know, and he started the Latinaires, and Joe was playing guitar with him. Tony Matamoros on tenor, and David Coronado on alto, and Cino Moreno on drums. They didn't have a bass, and they didn't have a piano. And they rocked, brother. During the weekends, they would do the Tejano thing, you know, and during the week, they would play African-American clubs,
When did the word Tejano start coming into play as Tex-Mex music?
Well, actually, it was Tex-Mex first. First, it was, see, because, that's a good question, because when people argue about Tejano music, la neta is, as you have Cajuns created Cajun music, Tejanos created Tejano music, mm-hmm. meaning that we were born and raised in Texas, mm-hmm. and we created, we're Mexican-Americans, we're Americans first. Mm-hmm. We're Mexican-Americans. We grew up listening to the blues, the big band, and rock and roll, and R&B and all of that. And we fused all of that with the Mexican song. And we Tejano music is horn bands, first and foremost. Then later on in decades, it became electronic and all of that, but it's a horn band. And at first you had orquesta a la Tommy Dorsey, you know, and all of that. And Mexico had Luis Alcaraz and all of that. And Texas had those big orchestras. And the difference was that the big orchestras were playing instrumentals all night long, much like Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller and all of that. And they had the vocalist on the side of the bandstand, and they would every so often come in and sing a song and then get back on the side. So they would sing 2-3 songs a night or four, but it was all instrumentals and a few vocals. Isidro López was playing with, I think, Juan Colorado, Beto Villa orchestras, or both. And he played alto, and he decided to reverse the thing. And he went from an 18-piece band down to, say, six horns and a rhythm section and sing all night long and play a couple of instrumentals. That's when Tejano music was born. And he is the godfather. But we didn't call it Tejano music. You know, it was just Isidro Lopez and Little Joe and the Latineers, Sun and the Sunliners, you know, Joe Bravo, Agustin Ramirez. And then they started calling it Tex-Mex. And this was, all of this happened first of all, the Latineers began with Eric Coronado in the mid-50s. Little Joe took over it, the band, in the late 50s. And then we developed the Latineers under Little Joe, and the Latineers started recording. And that's when La Onda began, and it was called La Onda, you know, Tejana. You know, they didn't say Tejana, nomás La Onda, Onda Musica, you know. And we started coming to California in the early 60s and traveling all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then as time went by, I think maybe the late 60s, early 70s, they wanted to call it Tex-Mex. And it went through that phase a little bit, but what happened is that people like Freddie Fender, Doug Sum, the Texas Tornadoes, started recording eclectic music, and they would do country and oldies and everything, and they did a couple of polkas, tejanas, you know. So that took the identity of Tex-Mex. It wasn't no longer La Onda music. It was an eclectic English format music, playing a couple of Tejano songs. After that, in the, what, the 80s maybe, the Tejano thing came in. You know, and I'm not really sure about this, but we used to have a promoter, the San Antonio, who lived in L.A., Tony, El Tejano, Treviño, and he would bring us out here. I dare say he's the one that coined it, Tejano, because he was telling us that tenía las tardeadas and, you know, Rancho Chino or around the L.A. area or wherever. Tenía mariachi, tenía conjuntos norteños and all that. And then they said, all right, ahora sigue tu música tejana, you know. So it may have been California who came up with the Tejano name first. But that, it took over as Tejano. Now, some couple of guys are trying to say, well, it's Chicano music. And I say, no, it's not. And the example is, as I said, Tejanos de Texas created Tejano music by fusing American licks on the horns, the solos on the guitars, guess chords, progressions with the Mexican song to a 2-4 beat, which is a polka, you know, or a ranchera, a 3-4 waltz, you know. That's where it was born. Chicano music is really American music, with Malo, you know, Tierra. Rudy and Steve Salas son Chicanos. Me and Little Joe somos Chicanos. But we play Tejano music.
Right.
And they played American Chicano music. American music by Chicanos, flavored with Latin music in there. So Tejano music is not Chicano music. It's Tejano music.
Right. Gotcha. All right. So how did you or when did you start playing an instrument?
I don't.
You don't?
And
you're a vocalist.
I'm a vocalist. I taught myself piano. I took a couple of lessons, private lessons. Then I went to, when I was living in Waco, took Piano 101. And I learned enough to read the notes. But with people around me that were good musicians, I learned how to utilize a piano to compose songs. And I know the theory, you know. In fact, I'm intrigued by chords. I love the chord progressions and stuff. But I won't be able to get up. I played a couple of my songs when I was with La Familia, that I wrote twice. I played two different songs on stage, but that's the extent of my playing on stage. So I'm not a musician as a with an instrument. My instrument is the vocal,
right?
But I use a piano for for working out. songs, you know, that I write, or if I want to know a certain song, I'll figure it out, you know.
Composing music, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, where did you fall in? I mean, it was between you and Little Joe. Was he the lead vocal and you were the secondary, or did you guys share the limelight?
We were both lead vocals.
Mm, okay. And so then, because I see in a lot of the albums, you know, Johnny and Little Joe y La Familia, or the vice versa, ¿verdad?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, of course, it was Joe's band from the beginning, mm-hmm. and he was the lead singer. Then he brought me in. Jesse brought me in. And I started singing English music first. And then they wanted me to sing. The first song I recorded when I learned to sing harmony was Cartucho Quemado, and I did the bridge harmony to Joe's lead. I sang the harmony on the bottom, but after that it was a hit, and because people liked the frequencies between our voices, we started recording the duet, which is really the forte of Little Joe and the Latineers, or Little Joe y La Familia. You know, I've got my hits, Joe's got his hits, but what really made those bands become a household word with our people was the duets, Las Nubes, and all of that. But the majority of the time when we did, 90% of the time when we sang together, I sang the lead, and he sang the harmony on top. You know, when we did trios, either one of the guys, Tony Matamoros, did the third on the bottom, I sang the lead, Joe did the harmony second on top. Or when my brother Rocky came in, he would take the lead, I would do the third on the bottom, and Joe would sing the harmony on top. And sometimes in between the song, we'd flip parts, you know, and depending on the song and the key.
Right. How many albums in total did you guys record? Más o menos. Más o menos,
más o menos 50 albums.
50 albums. Yeah. Wow. Do you have all of them?
No, I used to, but they mysteriously disappeared.
Aww,
you know,
that's so sad.
They're somewhere in the family.
Uh-huh.
But Joe and I did about at least 50, and I've got, I think, 13 on my own.
Okay, all right. Well, congratulations for that. I mean, that's a long journey, carnal.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how the people in Texas, as you went from city to city, how did they react? Was it all a family band, or was there interchanging with a lot of different people?
The first band went several years, the same members, and the only brothers in it were me and Joe, or Joe and I. And that's a good question, because I liked giving the answer to the reaction. We had a club called La Tropicana, just on the outskirts of Temple. That was boot camp for us before we recorded, okay? And we played there Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday tardeada, and Sunday night. And that's where the band became, you know, really tight. And the theme of the band was, we're going to have as much fun as we can, because we know half of the people that come here. And the ones we don't know, we're going to meet. And that is one of the things that helped Little Joe and the Latineers and Little Joe La Familia become successful, that it wasn't we're the artist and they're the audience. It was, we're all here together. I knew as we grew and the crowds got bigger y todo, I knew a large percent of the people that were always at the dances. And to this day, we have people that are fans, been in it 54 years, and they're still with us. But that was the environment. People started coming saying, man, let's go listen to this band who is young, energetic, and play a lot of soulful polkas. And we had a microphone hanging from the ceiling, because we couldn't, at the time, we didn't have a mic stand. And Joe and I sang into it together. And the PA system was carried in like a suitcase by the trumpet. When we finally got a trumpet player in the band, and it's just open it up. I mean, it was, you know, very, very primitive But the people enjoyed themselves to death, and so did we. So that attitude is what got the band to expand, and the first 50 miles radius, 100 mile radius, and then 150, 200 miles in the valley, then the west, and then we came southwest, and then midwest, and all over the place, you know. With that attitude.
When did it change from the Latin ears to La Familia?
That happened in 1970 because of an awareness. 1968, 69, we were hanging out in San Jose, playing all over the place, coming to L.A., playing the Hollywood Palladium and all of that. And Luis Gasca, who is originally from Houston, they call him the Little Giant in 65 or 60, early 60s, he won first trumpet in the Newport Jazz Festival. He's a, you know, mega the jazz musician. And Joe Gallardo, a genius trombone, he's the one that wrote the scores for Las Nubes and all that. They grew up together in Houston. Joe's from Corpus, buddy. They went to school, I think, together in Houston. Well, when we were hanging out, Luis found out we were before Joe Gallardo came in, we were in San Jose, so he took us to Hyde and Ashbury to see the hippies, you know. At this time, we're wearing tailor-made, beautiful satin and silk tuxedos, you know, everything tailor-made, patent leather shoes and everything. And he says, I want to show you the hippies, carnal. You know, all right. So we get into the van, and we literally drove over there, and we saw all the hippies out there, how they were dressed, and first thing we liked about it, they were smoking grass, and said, well, we've got that part. I mean, we've been doing that forever, so it's in the family. It's a tradition, you know. Uh-huh. So we got that, and Joe turned around and said, okay, guys, throw away the tuxedos. We're changing, but not only because of the attire. What happened was when Jesse heard the Beatles first, their first recording, he came and says, I'm going to learn this, when I saw her standing there, says, I'm going to learn this song. These guys are going to be big, man. Mm-hmm. Jesse could see that, you know? So we learned that. When we came to the hippie thing and they were friendly, you know, growing up the way I did, we went downtown, pura raza, you know, packed con raza from South and West Texas during the cotton fields. And of course, Los Blancos that didn't like it. And I didn't have conversations with Anglos. The only time we talked was when I was buying something, you know. Mm-hmm. There were no conversing. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't talk to us. When we got into the hippie movement and the peace and love, the Los Beatles, and we saw the world scope picture of it, it changed. That's when I let my guard down. That's when I started walking into American establishments, English, Anglo establishments, and didn't worry anymore about if somebody going to attack me verbally or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started having conversations con blancos. Mm-hmm. And it was all about a whole different world that even the old guard, the Los Blancos, didn't like this young generation. But we jumped in it head, you know, first, and we became part of the movement. And that's why in 1970, Joe hired, we changed from some of the old Latin ears guys were dropped out. We brought in some guys from Houston, and Joe Gallardo wrote the score for Las Nubes. And we did the album Para La Gente. And we were always involved with Cesar Chavez and La Raza Unida and, you know, getting into trouble. And one time we were in Galveston, and Joe almost incited a riot there and talking La Razito. And I got hair down to my butt and leather boots that Rainbow Cobbler, where Santana had them made in San Francisco. We went in there. Luis took us in there. And we met Santana, and we went to his house, and we became part of it. And we're in Galveston, and La Raza all hyped up, and all of a sudden, you know, a million cops marched up to the bandstand, put me and Joe in handcuffs, and took us to jail.
Wow.
You know, so we're cool. Los Chicanos cops, hey, don't worry, Joe, Johnny, don't worry. It's just a preliminary thing. They have to do this, you know. Ahorita te sacan, don't worry about it, you know. So that's what we were doing. Being, because we are cotton pickers, we know what it feels like. We know what the farm workers are going through. We don't have to see a video. We know them. There are people. Cesar Chavez heard Las Nubes and adopted it and took it to the farm workers and looked up Joe. And said, he heard Joe doing an interview somewhere in California, and he looked him up and wanted to meet him. And so the bond began, and we started playing at the Berkeley Greek Theater along with Tower Power and Malo. We went to Malo's rehearsal when they were rehearsing Suavecito 2 recorded, you know. Mm-hmm. So Cal Jader and the Grateful Dead and Rick Stevens and I were good friends and blah, 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 and all of that. But the reason we changed to La Familia in 1970, because of, well, we got involved with La Raza and we got involved with the hippies and the awareness. And then my grandfather, Coronel the Villista, is always in the blood, you know. So Joe said, you know what, we're going to call this album Para La Gente. And we had this young guy do the artwork with a double-headed eagle.
Oh, wow.
You know, mm-hmm. A beautiful artwork. The eagle spread out the wings and two heads, you know, facing left and facing right.
Well, you know that is an indigenous symbol.
I didn't know that for sure. Mm-hmm. But it was part of the indigenous world that we were, you know, so in love and inspired with. And I guess, I don't know where Joe got it, but he had it drawn up, the artwork, and it represented me and Joe, because we were brothers, La Familia, mm-hmm. singing together. But beyond that, it was meant to, for us Mexican-Americans and our brothers and sisters Mexicanos de Mexico. That's what Para La Gente and the double-headed eagle was about. And beyond that, Central and South America. Toda la gente, la raza café de nosotros.
Right.
But basically Mexican-American Chicanos and Mexicans, you know.
Right.
And that's when we became La Familia.
Right. And now I've met Jimmy and Lucy.
Yeah.
Jimmy said that he was running around with Reyes López Tijerina. Did you get a chance to meet him?
I sure did. Joe and I met him. We went to his house, and we had a very nice talk with him. We loved him, and we admired him, you know. And I love New Mexico. It changed my life, but we'll talk about that. But we had the pleasure of meeting Reyes.
Good, good. All right.
El Tigre.
All right. And so now we're in the beginning of the 1970s. Let's move forward from here. How long were you with the band?
I was until 1984.
Okay.
August the 10th.
Now tell me, between 1970 and 1984, tell me the ups and downs.
Well, it was all ups. I mean, gracias a Dios.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm amazed, and you know, I say this humbly. Mm-hmm. But since we started as the Latineers, and we recorded Por Un Amor, which is my signature song, it's said that 15, 20 years ago, it was said that it had sold over 1.5 million copies from the original, you know, through different labels that it's gone through. But that took us everywhere. And until the 24th, almost 25 years that I was with Joe, we had packed houses, man. In between one or two things here and there. But we were blessed with so many big, beautiful dances. And it was all good. But what happened is, you know, we were political without even knowing it. Well, we were supporting La Raza Unida and Cesar and Ramsey Muñiz, you know, and the Brown Berets, of which I am a proud member, and all of that. And it just fell into place because of how we were born, fighting the double standard, fighting racism and all of that. So we were having a good time recording and traveling all over the world and this and that. And then we campaigned for Jimmy Carter. For he was going to go for a second term, and we did some campaigning for him in San Antonio, and then we went to El Valle, McAllen, where we had the honor of meeting Ted Kennedy, and he came over to our dance. We have photos with him. We met him at the motel where we were staying first, with all the security and everything, took photos, and he was a beautiful man. And then we did the gig, and all of that went on. We went to Denver, Colorado, and they flew us in a Learjet that I got a chance to fly, and not knowing how to fly a Learjet, but he let me have it, and I did it, mm-hmm. you know, for a few minutes. And then when it was over, Reagan won. Mm-hmm. So I've been with Joe for 24 years, no questions asked, ever. Blind faith, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that was my job. But when we campaigned for Carter and he lost, my brother being the manager, Tony Topp, the eldest, at this time he had retired and he was our manager, band manager. He also sang. And he sang, I mean, if you closed your eyes, you'd think you were listening to Nat King Cole. Mm-hmm. That's why we love the big band and the Latineers are what they are with the horn licks and all, because our brothers taught us to learn to love the big band, Sinatra and Atkin Cole and all of that. So Tony Topp, Top Sergeant, was in charge of booking the band. So immediately after the campaign and Reagan won, I mean immediately, the following day, Topp makes some calls, he hustles, and then he calls a meeting, and I'm there, and Tony Matamoros, the foreman, is there, and Joe and Top, and he says, guess what, man? I got you a gig at the White House for the inauguration for Reagan.
Wow.
And everybody said, wow, man, and of course. And then I said, I don't understand this. We just campaigned for Carter. Mm-hmm. We went out and said we'd die for him, you know, and we'd spill blood for him, or his blood is my blood, you know. Mm-hmm. We were sincere. Mm-hmm. And now you want us to go play for Reagan? I don't have anything against him personally, but, you know, we just barely finished the campaign. And for the first time in my life, career with Joe, I said, I'm not going to do it. And they were shocked, man. They looked at me. Mm-hmm. And, wow, what do you mean? I said, we just campaigned for Carter. Hey, Johnny, it's over. You know, in other words, it looked great on our resume and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm sorry, Carnal. You know, I said, I'm not going to do it. I said, you go with the band and do it. But I can't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't thinking business. I was thinking emotionally.
Right.
But beyond that.
You were thinking principle.
Principles.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Beyond the emotion. Mm-hmm. So I said no. And to my surprise, Joe decided not to go. Mm-hmm. And but that's when I rocked the boat, mm-hmm. you know. And I had already started coming into myself, producing me on my own. And I didn't realize that was rocking the boat. Joe didn't tell me. You know, I used his studio and the musicians, I paid him. He didn't say no. But unbeknownst to me, it began to make waves, business waves, you know, between Joe and I. Mm-hmm. And the rest, I went about four or five years, and it got rough, mm-hmm. and it got worse, mm-hmm. business and personally. And in 1984, August 10th, I said, I've had it, and I quit, you know. Wow. But there's a lot of things that happened in between that you can call harassment, you know. Mm-hmm. I was put against, between a rock and a hard place, mm-hmm. thinking that I would choose to be a subservient, you know. And I said, no, I can't do that, man. I was given a choice. stand down. You are no longer a quote-unquote star.
Mm-hmm.
You are no longer one of the you'll always sing your lead and you'll always record and create quote-unquote hits, but you'll be paid like a sideman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're being demoted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all political for the band.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all emotional and everything. So I had a choice, and I said, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to quit.
And you walked away.
I walked away.
All right. What have you been doing since then?
I've been learning life.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a hard knocks. I didn't know how to run a band. I didn't know how to talk on the mic. I didn't know how to rehearse a band. I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know business. I have to walk you through all this, but I started a band, Third Coast. It was an excellent band. It was all electronic because if you heard the band, you'd think I have a full orchestra up there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have horns. I had three monster keyboard players, super rhythm track. But I did that because I wanted to play not only the Tejano music, but the English stuff that I wanted to do like that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then 85% of the promoters wouldn't work with me, so I went broke because I was paying out of my back, out of my pocket. I paid the musicians. It wasn't their fault. We did gigs, and I was working with up-and-coming promoters who wanted to help me but weren't established, ¿me entiendes?
Yeah.
So it was rough all the way around. So I kicked around for decades. You know, I lived in different towns in Texas. I lived in New Mexico. I lived in Nevada. I lived in California. I went back to Texas, blah, blah, blah. But what happened, I had an epiphany in 1995, and the American Indian, indigenous people of New Mexico, saved my life. I did a sweat, and I walked out of there 100% clean and sober for life.
Wow. Okay.
And because of that, friends that were station managers in Albuquerque, because I was hanging out in Albuquerque, I was burned out, so I got off the road. And the radio manager said, come work for us. I said, doing what? Selling. AE, account executive. I don't know anything. We'll teach you. I said, no, you don't understand. I don't know anything about anything except music. We'll teach you. So because I cleaned up in that sweat that I did, the Great Spirit allowed me to learn from zero to using computers, to becoming a salesperson, to graduating to a marketing consultant.
All right, Colonel. You've written a book. We've run out of time. Where can they get this story? Because this is an interesting story, and there's so much more to tell, ¿verdad?
There's a lot more to tell in the book. It's my autobiography, and everything is true that I wrote on there.
¿Cómo se llama? What's the title?
The Cotton Picker, An Odyssey.
And it's by Johnny Hernandez.
By Johnny Hernandez. You can go to Amazon.com and just look up Johnny Hernandez, The Cotton Picker. You can put The Cotton Picker in Odyssey or just The Cotton Picker. Amazon gave it a 5-star rating from the beginning, and it's still a 5-star rating. Or you can go to Johnny Hernandez, www.johnnyhernandez.biz, B-I-Z. And that's my website, and you'll click on the page that says the book, The Cotton Picker, and it'll open up, and it'll give you a choice, too. Because you can also get it in Kindle, you know.
All right. Okay. Well, that's going to do it for us, Raza. We want to thank Mr. Johnny Hernandez. You'll come back, ¿verdad?
I'd love to. Thank you so much for the invitation. KUCR, I'm proud to be here, and I'm proud to be talking to you guys and all your audience. Raza, you know, thank you for everything you've done for us.
All right, that's going to do it for us, Raza. Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Chicano Highlights with the Beto Man. We've had a very interesting and special guest, Mr. Johnny Hernandez. We will see you hasta la próxima. Ahí te guacho. And remember to tune in to EastLAReview.com and ChicanoTexMex.com.